verse 9 through 11.
Much people of the Jews, therefore, knew that he was there, and they came not for Jesus' sake only, but that they might see Lazarus also, whom he had raised from the dead. But the chief priests consulted that they might put Lazarus also to death, because that by reason of him many of the Jews went away and believed on Jesus.
So when it says in verse 9, much people of the Jews therefore knew that he was there, who was there?
Jesus.
All right. And they came not for his sake only, but that they might see Lazarus also, whom he had raised from the dead. Now you'll notice that when you add the next two verses, it would seem that their primary concern was first to see the one who died. Even though it states it this way, they first wanted to, see Lazarus. It doesn't say it quite that way, but I think that's the implication, as well as Jesus. But you see, it's like worded the other way. You would do the same thing, too, if you knew of an individual who had been dead 4 days and was now alive. You'd probably think first, go to him and look at him and see if that was real, have him speak, and so forth. And then, of course, the most logical thing is then you turn to the one who performed that miracle. But, I mean, your emotion, the excitement would probably be that way. So it's interesting now, isn't it, that at this particular time of Jesus' first advent, when he's about to die, that they even plotted to slay Lazarus as well. Normally you don't think of that. And it's John that brings this into the gospel. You would not get this item of information from Matthew, Mark, and Luke. So he adds this to the gospel as though this would be an item of great interest to the Christian church subsequently when they read the gospel, to have that additional item of information brought to their attention. Any comments or observations with regard to these three verses?
Brother Frank?
Yes.
I don't know if we mentioned it before, but how do we suppose John was privy to some of this kind of information, through contact with some of the priests, or was it just...
Yes, I think you're answering your own question. Because what I think you may have in your mind is that when John, when they fled in the Garden of Gethsemane, John and Peter followed, but it was John who was on the inside of the house, and this is a priestly home. He opened the door so that Peter could go in. So John was related to the priestly family, probably through marriage. We don't have the information, but the fact that he could be inside and then let Peter in, it suggests, therefore, he would be privy to secret information that the others would. Yes, I think that's true, that he would know the reports going around, circulating. Any other comment or observation?
Do you suppose they just abandoned that plot concerning Lazarus once Jesus was off the scene? They thought that was enough? Or?
I would think so, that while they might have planned it, they became so engrossed getting him dispatched, Jesus, that they lost sight of the other. There's no subsequent information. I do think they, when it was fresh, it's like, oh, the whole world will believe him if we don't do something. But then they were satisfied with having Jesus.
They couldn't put Lazarus to death. Because he wasn't he didn't commit blasphemy, as they said. He was just raised from the dead.
That is true. That's a very good observation. It is true that when it came to capital punishment, it had to be cleared through the occupying power, through Rome. Any other observation?
Father Frank?
Yes.
It's interesting that our Lord did say that even if they did see one raised from the dead, they would not believe. And here they did see Lazarus. They went to see him, and they didn't believe.
Yeah. We called attention to that in a prior study. I don't know if it's the last one, the one before, that even when he called attention, though one raised from the dead, that very parable uses the word Lazarus. It's the parable of Lazarus. And I think it's equated with this to show that he was aware that even Lazarus was going to be involved. If you study the Gospels from that standpoint, it's amazing how much Jesus knew in advance. Much more than we normally think of. That, so maybe in his prayer life or some other way, he received information of which we're not cognizant, except as we see certain things crop out here and there. Such as that 24th chapter of Matthew, he sees clearly all down the age. But of the day and the hour, he didn't know. But he might have known even almost a year. By looking at that detail, he knew about the wise and faithful servant, he knew about the parable of the wise and foolish virgins, and what would be involved with that experience, and how that those that were ready would go into the marriage. Why, that information is startling, that he has this like foreknowledge that down through the age, and that it would be a long time. Any other observation or comment? All right, now let's then read verse 12. Through 19.
On the next day, much people that were come to the feast, when they heard that Jesus was coming to Jerusalem, took branches of palm trees and went forth to meet him, and cried, Hosanna, blessed is the King of Israel that cometh in the name of the Lord. And Jesus, when he had found a young ass, sat thereon, as it is written, Fear not, daughter of Zion, behold, thy king cometh sitting on an ass's colt. These things understood not his disciples at the first, but when Jesus was glorified, then remembered they that these things were written of him, and that they had done these things unto him. The people therefore that was with him when he called Lazarus out of the grave and raised him from the dead bear record. For this cause the people also met him, for that they heard that he had done this miracle. The Pharisees therefore said among themselves, Perceive ye not, ye prevail nothing? Behold, the world is gone after him.
All right, now returning to verse 12, that's a very helpful verse there. On the next day to what?
After having the dinner at the Lazarus house.
All right.
6 days before Passover, the next day after the 6 days.
All right, in other words, 5 days before Passover. Both are true. This is after the Lazarus supper. But John supplies us with a detail that is helpful because it was necessary that Jesus be presented to Jerusalem as the Passover lamb the fifth day before his death. It's worded differently in the Old Testament. It states it the same thing from another standpoint. Do you recall how it's stated there? That on the 10th day, that's right, on the 10th day of Nisan, the Passover lamb was selected. And it was then slain, on the 14th day of Nisan, and we find out later that it's 3 o'clock in the afternoon on the 14th of Nisan. But actually, another thing too, when you say first, second, third, fourth, that's sometimes a little confusing, because let us take, this is January. When you say January 1, what do we say? 1987. But January 1, 1987 is a newborn babe. There's no length of time. So as soon as it's midnight, and then it's 12 hours later, 18 hours, but the year is it's the 1987th year, but only 1986 years have elapsed, plus a few hours or a few days. So when you say the year 1987, it can mean a lot of things. What are you talking about? The beginning of the year, the middle of the year, or the end of the year? Makes a big difference when you're doing it mathematically. And so then when it says the sixth day before, then the next one is the fifth day before. But it doesn't tell you, just the statement as to what hour, unless we read the detail here, which of course shows to be early in the day. Notice it tells that much people were come to the feast when they heard that Jesus was coming to Jerusalem. They took branches of trees. I think that sentence should be just slightly changed, because it gives they would be there, much people, at the feast irregardless of whether Jesus was there. See? So it's not really punctuated right. They would be there anyway, because it's the Passover that is about to be observed. But when they heard that Jesus was there, that excited them even more. Instead of being maybe up on the hill cooking their dinner or something like that, they would forego this to make sure they're down, because they hear Jesus is there. So they come down there now to see about what's going to happen. Now they took branches of palm trees and went forth to meet him and cried, "Hosanna, blessed is the King of Israel that cometh in the name of the Lord." Any comments on that?
Only one little observation that I imagine that the hillsides must have been raked of all the trees in AD 70 or because you don't see too many palm trees around the vicinity, even to have strewn them on the foot on the walk.
Yes. That is true. There's much evidence archaeologically, as well as even from airplane, when you look down, where you could see that in past ages it was a fertile area. And there's this book that's been written, Ages of Chaos by Velazovsky, and he is trying to prove a certain point, which I'm not going to go into now, but one of his observations is that you had all kinds of incense trees on the way down to Jericho, all kinds of vegetation, which today when you go up, it's desert. It's all desert.
I'm just reading that every, you know, when they were invaded in AD 70, the Romans had every tree, there were so many trees, there was no room for any more to hang the Jews on.
But crucifixes. You're reading, yes, Vespasian, and then Titus later. And Josephus wrote about it. But this other, about the vegetation being there, there was a time, and it's also called the Land of Promise earlier, and it describes that Land of Promise, how fruitful it is, but things have changed subsequent to that, when the Israelites left Egypt to go into this land of plenty. So there's been much sterility that has taken place due to the deforestation of the land, and that's why the Jews today are planting trees like mad by the millions.
100 million.
Yeah. And because they want to bring the land back to its former productivity. So it would be true that they could strip certain branches from it, and that in itself wouldn't do it, but they had to have the trees in order to have the palm branches to strew in this path. Yes. Yes?
This one also shows the subordination of Jesus to the Father. The King of Israel came in the name of Jehovah.
Yes. In other words, Jesus as King is subordinate or subservient to his Father who sent him. He comes in the name of Jehovah. But of course, we don't have Jehovah in the New Testament mentioned as Jehovah. But we can prove that many of these places where it says the word Lord, that you have to consider it's just Jehovah, not Jesus. But there are a lot of other places where the word Lord in the New Testament does mean Jesus. But here, it doesn't. The word Lord here is Jehovah. Yes?
I was wondering about the significance of using the palm tree. I know in Revelation, when it talks about the great multitude, it says that they have their clothes with white robes and they have palms in their hands. Is there any special significance to it being a palm tree?
Yes. Palms of victory. Whether we have the hymn to that. Palms of victory.
Is there any precedent in the Old Testament for it being a victory? It seemed like the people kind of knew to do that.
Well, that was the custom in other lands like Rome when the various emperors who were generals returned from successful expedition, that the people would strew branches in their way. The thought being like that they want to show how much they appreciate you and that they don't want your feet to get sullied by the earth. You must put something in between, like Sir Walter Raleigh put his coat down lest the Queen of England step in the mud with her beautiful slippers on or whatever, as a gesture. So that laying down would suggest that you're trying to honor the individual who is approaching, and it is a symbol usually associated with victory.
Reverend, do I recall correctly, did they make wreaths for the head of the palm trees too?
Well, usually...
It was runners and things, yeah, that were victorious. And
the Olympics. Well, it wasn't with so much with palms as olive branches and other type of foliage that they would put around, entwined around the head as a garland. Yes.
Palms were also used in the Feast of the Tabernacle. Is there any tie in there?
The palms are used in the which?
The palm trees. In the Feast of the Tabernacles, it uses the branches of the palm tree.
That's one of several that are mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Would there be any tie in there?
It's a symbol of their freedom, liberty, and so forth, but there it isn't limited to one kind. It's just it's actually a flashback to a town in Egypt called Succoth. Succoth, which the Jews even today don't realize. And that was the first stop after they left Ramesses. The Jews, that was the rallying point, the first city. But from there, when they went, after one day's journey, that place was in a desert, but there were trees there. And they got shelter in connection with that particular place, and those trees and shrubbery and so forth became a memorial that they not only went to Ramesses, this is the first day of separation. They're separating themselves. But when they went to Ramesses, they didn't separate. That was the rallying point, the first point. But the second point, they were now putting Egypt between them and their destination. And so it became to call this the Feast of Sukkot as one, as well as other feasts of ingathering and there are about three or four names, other names. But based on that, so they have a variety of trees in that celebration, whatever is convenient. And then they would make booths also with the branches as a temporary shelter. And that's a flashback, a memorial to what they did after that first day's journey. When they left there, then the cloud began to be the awning under which they traveled. And it mentions in the scripture that it was from that after the first day, that point, that subsequent thereto, the cloud followed them in their journey, which also becomes meaningful. All this is lost sight of in tradition and in history, which is very startling, very nice, and it's too bad that they, in their own history, they're not that familiar. But palm itself here, it only mentions the one that was considered the symbol. Where are we now? What verse? That was several verses.
13,
right. Let's see, we go down. And Jesus, when he had found a young ass, sat thereon, as it is written, "Fear not, daughter of Zion, behold, thy king cometh, sitting on an ass's colt." These things understood not his disciples at first, but when Jesus was glorified, then they remembered these things were written of him, and that they had done these things unto him. In other words, John is saying, when he wrote this, he doesn't want us to think that he was aware of the fulfillment of that prophecy. No, he was just like the others, in ignorance of it. But of course, he writes this from up in Asia Minor a long, long time later, and he's now saying that we didn't understand at the time, including myself. See? But now, in writing it, he now records it as a fulfillment of prophecy at that season. When this occurred. Yes?
In the article I read, which would be, it's good for us to remember too, that in the period of the judges, didn't they all ride a white ass? And that was typical, so no doubt this would be a cult.
Well, that's been picked up by other nations too, so like you have the Emperor Hirohito on certain occasions, he had a white horse. This is in recent times. And several of the emperors had a particularly nice Arabian horse as a symbol of their authority. And what you're referring to is the judges. In the Old Testament, it mentions that the judges of Israel, when they went around Israel to listen to cases, like have court, open court, they traveled around. And wherever this became a symbol, if you saw coming down the road one on this particular animal, you'd say, must be one of the judges. He's coming to our, it's like a, this is the origination of circuit court, because in ancient times, the court moved into the locality for your convenience, and usually it was only at certain appointed times of the year.
In Revelation, the church.
Yes, Jesus and his followers are behind him, also on white horses. He's on a white horse, they're on a white horse. And that they are now pictured as tried, proven, and faithful. Not just tentatively kings, but in that picture. But you'll notice it doesn't use the say that this is a white horse, because I think that would might construe from that something a little above and beyond what is intended here. But they would see that and make this, that this is the king, like the judge coming into the city. Here's the king whom they feel after that wonderful miracle of Lazarus. That would be a stupendous miracle, that this is the one, the Messiah.
It seems that not even all the detail, because that's not the major point here, that the ass wasn't written on before. Isn't that one of the other criteria?
Yeah.
And that's omitted.
Yes, well, of course, this is written subsequent to the other three Gospels. And in the other three Gospels, the narration goes into how he found that. Because when he became in the vicinity of Bethany and Bethphage, that he sent the disciples into the city. He said, go into the city, and at that crossroads there, you'll notice, and he probably even pointed. And we know where that is on the road, because when you go to Jerusalem from Jericho, when you first come up, there's a deep, going in a deep, like, ravine, and you circle back again, you go in again, and you come out to one place where you see Siloam, right? You can see it right down, look over the hill, and you see the southern part of the city quite clearly. And then as you circle around, you lose sight of it because of other intervening obstacles. But there's one platform there where he could even point, if necessary, where it would be. That you will find. And in one gospel it mentions that, that's where it was. And incidentally, we were there, and we realized the road that was involved, and there's a piece of property down there where they have some beautiful flowers, and a fence, and a home. And it's like all by itself, and it's rather strange, because the property like starts out with a point at 2 feet, 3 feet, 4 feet, 5 feet wide. It's like a sliver there. And that sliver, there are two different paths. One that goes straight ahead, up an incline to the steps, to the traditional steps where the trees are, where he went to have the memorial. And the other goes down to, like Hinnom, into the deeper recesses of the city, down a gully and all. And this is right there. So I think those two paths are very ancient, and they still exist today. So you could point, like you feel, this is the property, although not the same building or the same inhabitants there. And this corresponds, too, with another thing, because when we read about the supper, right? And that comes before this. In other words, the tomb of Lazarus is earlier than this protrusion of the road where you can look down on the city. And it's still in the vicinity of Bethany. And he stayed there, it says, 6 days before the Passover they prepared the supper. So it would be logical that the tomb would be fairly close to where his residence was, because it's his tomb where he was laid. And then when you proceed further, you come to this place where he could ask about the animals, to get the mother colt, the mother donkey, as well as the young colt. So it fits into the narrative beautifully, and this is one of several things which we feel that the tomb of Lazarus, its location, is probably authentic. Because that struck such a stark incision into the minds of the people. They would not forget that. In fact, just like we like to go to the Garden Tomb, because we feel this is the place where it seems the evidence that Jesus died, that if you were a resident, a Jew, as a look, you would like also to think of, well, that place is where he raised Lazarus from the dead. That would become a very notable landmark without even having to be told it was, because of what was associated with his being raised from the dead. So I think that was revered as a spot, just as the Garden Tomb was, and where you can see where they made a V in the entrance, where the stone is worn away from so many people going over that spot. When we went there in 1967, there was only one other man in that area at that time, and we were there maybe 4 to 6 hours in that whole area, and this was a minister from Texas. Since then, they've been having 400,000 a year, easy, going to that particular place. So it means when we went there, when it was not too well felt, and that's recent, 1967, that's only 20 years ago, now it's flooded and is given some quite a bit of recognition by scholars today. But if at that time there were so few, it would mean that prior to that time, it was all buried over with dirt and debris, and only recently, in 1873, was it revealed, the Garden Tomb area, showing that from the time that it was known and used back at the time of Hadrian, because he also captured the city, as well as Titus, that when that tomb is uncovered and you see that worn spot there, that was from previous pilgrims way, way back, almost like over, say, 1,800 years ago. So that then you can see it was a revered spot. So I think that anciently it was quite well known, this area. And it fits in beautifully with the narrative. That you walk along that road from Jericho and here it is. It's the same road. It's only when you go down to Jericho at the other end that you can see the old road. The old road is like beside the other end. That they traveled in the valley. After going over top the Mount of Olives, instead of being on a nice macadam road, which is scaled, down by modern engineering, where you go by a road, you can look over the side and see the old road. And you could say that'd be a scorching road, because the further down you are, the hotter it is. And there's no trees down there or anything now today. And it's been completely abandoned. But that road comes up and joins the other as you get nearer to Jerusalem.
Is that the road we took that did a lot of switchbacks?
To see the monastery, the St. George's Monastery on the hill on the side of a cliff. You left the main road. You went over to that little road, but it's chopped up so you only see portions of it. It's almost like a path. But it even had some tar in it or asphalt, portions of it then. But you ignored that because you wanted to get over to see that wadi where the other was. So we. But that wasn't a more ancient road. So it all fits beautifully with the thing that you could travel from Jericho when he healed the blind man, go up that road, and you can see just how the situation fits in beautifully. Especially when you compare it with the other narratives, because it tells you a little more than John does here. Now, he's quoting a prophecy. What prophecy would that be?
Zechariah 9:9.
All right. There's some language somewhat like that also in Isaiah someplace.
Isaiah 62:11.
Well, whatever it is.
It just doesn't say anything about the ass. It just says you.
No, it talks about the daughter of Zion and things along that line, and about salvation, which they are associating with this. He's coming, and that means the Roman yoke is about to be broken. Here he is. Here's the Messiah. Couldn't you see the enthusiasm with being there, his raising the dead, and his professing to be Messiah? That how happy they would be, really jubilant. So that the Pharisees could say, near the last verse that was read, but the whole world's gone after him because of their jubilation. Right now you called attention to about the colt never having been ridden before, and that this animal upon which he would be seated, being docile, he's like Lord over the animal creation, as it were, as well, becomes subservient to his authority. Because, you know, when you break the colts in the West, they jump up and down and they try to break that spirited horse. They're pretty ornery, even the little colts today, the mules and so forth, until they're broken in. And the people, therefore, that were with him when he called Lazarus out of his grave and raised him from the dead, it's these people that were the chief instigators of arousing this tumultuous recognition, because we suggested that when they saw Lazarus come forth from the tomb, that they'd be crazy. They'd run down the roads and say, why, we just witnessed the most outstanding miracle you could see. You could be sure that without the press and the modern means of communication that everybody knew on the Mount of Olives and in Bethany and Bethphage as to what had happened in that area where this miracle had been performed. So they are responsible. It's saying here they bore record of this raising from the dead of Lazarus. For this cause, the people also met him, for that they heard that he had done this miracle. See, it's a strong language there, but it's pretty prosaic here. And then the reaction of the Pharisees. And this is, it's interesting, too. Now, think of the Pharisees. It's strange how your heart could be so hardened that with such evidences that you look on them as with suspicion, and you feel that you want to even murder that person because of his popularity. It tells us then that envy, jealousy, was the root cause of their opposition to Jesus, because they saw in him an inherent threat to their recognition before the people as leaders. Because if he was recognized, they'd forget them. They'd forget these ones, who they paid, they're scared to death of the Pharisees, lest they be put out of the synagogue. And so now, if they thought too highly of Jesus, they'd forget that threat. So there's a lot here. I mean, if you would put yourself back there, here's two classes, one that joyously recognized Jesus, not only for that miracle, but also for other things that he had done. And here's this other class that are plotting his death, as well as Lazarus. Can we continue a little more? Let's read verse 20 through 2.
Brother Frank?
Yes.
Can I just make a comment on that jealousy? I was just trying to quick look up the scripture in Song of Solomon 8:6, where it talks about that jealousy is cruel as the grave. Its coals are coals of fire, which have a most vehement flame. So that the maybe that was not.
That isn't the right application.
I was going to say, I just realized that's godly jealousy.
It's appropriate as far as having another meaning, like you're suggesting, but not in that place.
Yeah, that's the proper type of jealousy.
Because a person who is really in love, lovesick for somebody else, that is a burning flame, like jealousy. And jealousy is a good word as well as a bad word. Because the word zealous is the same word as jealous. But jealous is a bad connotation, that we have today. But when you think of it from the standpoint of a burning zeal and fervency of desire, then it puts a different slant on it.
20 through 22,
did
you
say? Yeah.
And there were certain Greeks among them that came up to worship at the feast. The same came therefore to Philip, who was of Bethsaida, of Galilee, and desired him, saying, Sir, we would see Jesus. Philip cometh and telleth Andrew. And again, Andrew and Philip tell Jesus.
Any comments on those verses, anything?
I wish to assume that these were heathen Greeks. They were not proselytes.
I think so, because of the context.
Yeah, because of the emphasis.
Yes. These are not Greek Jews, because that's nothing so...
That's the word come to worship. Would indicate
he had
something.
Mm-hmm. That's right, too.
President, you gave a talk on this one.
I did.
When this was about to occur, where there's a switch now, and the not the Jews. We call the other people that are not Jews.
Gentiles.
Yes, well, I think there's several things here, one of which is along that line. First thing, Jesus' ministry said, I am come to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. And that would mean that his ministry primarily was focused on the Jews in Israel, and that he traversed the land from north to south and east to west, as it were, even going up into Lebanon in order to accomplish his mission. But these Grecians who come may have been like proselytes to the Jewish faith from a different land. Perhaps some light of this would be shown by why did they come to Philip? Yes.
In Acts 8:27, it says, a man of Ethiopia, an eunuch of great authority under Candace, queen of the Ethiopians, who had charge of all her treasure and had come to Jerusalem for to worship.
Yes.
That's from my margin here.
Yeah.
In regard to the priests. He is from East, they're from Ethiopia, which is a different land.
Why would they go to Philip? I mean, was that just haphazard, or can you reimagine something here? Yes?
Philip is some kind of evangelist, or evangelist type.
Yeah. Yes?
Yes.
But you'll notice it didn't say, for instance, John, I think, earlier mentions, remember we were discussing some time period, many studies ago, in the book of John, where it mentioned Philip as being of Bethsaida. It mentioned that earlier. So to mention it here, I would think that he has something else in mind, because he's already covered the fact that he was a resident of Bethsaida in the first chapter or so of John, in a very early chapter. But here, location is that the tetrarch that was resident in Bethsaida was called what? The tetrarch of, what do we call it? Galilee. And Galilee is also associated with another thought. It says, and thou Galilee of the
Gentiles.
Right, of the nations, or the Gentiles. So that area up there, there were many Gentiles. There was, of course, the Romans, too. And the Greek language really was the language of the day, more than Roman. But the Romans used the Latin language in like marriage ceremonies, legal courts. The Roman language was used, but very little used in conversational language. So Greek was the language of the empire, generally speaking. They not only took the language and embraced it, the Romans, but their architecture and their sculptors and even the mythological gods of Greece were like incorporated into Rome. Yes?
Where did Aramaic come into the picture?
That Aramaic or Syriac form of Hebrew is Palestine at this time was a province of Syria. It really was Syria. But the province of Syria was broken up into fragments, like counties as it were, and you had three or four tetrarchs who were appointed of this region, and his name was Herod also. Yeah, the one up there was another Herod. So you had a Herod up there, you had a Herod in Judea and as well, depending on what period of history back there. So Philip evidently was the one who probably was more cultured in some respects, even though he was simplistic in other ways, than more than the fishermen, because when they spoke of John and of Peter, and even Andrew would be, they would say that they were, the populace realized they were ignorant men, in the sense of unschooled, unlettered. But that didn't mean they were all unlettered. So Philip must have had some sort of an appearance to whom they could address themselves. But then he went to Andrew. Yes.
When we think of these Greeks then more or less like the Roman centurions, they were natives of a foreign land but living in Israel and had a great deal of faith in God, apparently to demonstrate even by their actions. And that would fit the anti-type answer, because these Jews with a great deal of faith in their Jewish religion and God, but living in Christendom.
Yes, those who are not, I don't like to say superficially Christians or like in that sense, but yes.
Yeah, Brother Allen called my attention to the fact that it was Philip that the eunuch came to also, that I just mentioned, or Acts.
Or the Philip was taken to.
Yeah, he was told to go.
To go to the eunuch. So he's transported, as it were, almost both ways, but one way very miraculously, and the other he was directed of the Lord to go down to this. Yeah.
But the seventh year is the apostle. It says, and the same came therefore to Philip, which was of Bethsaida of Galilee. And if you go back to the first chapter of John, in the 44th verse, it says, now Philip was of Bethsaida, the city of Andrew and Peter. Philip findeth Nathanael and called unto him.
Well, that's what we called attention to, right? That this early chapter.
But that won't be the same as Philip at the, that won't be the
same. Oh, I see what you mean now. I get it. But actually, it so happens that both were evangelistic. That's the strange part. They were, but this Philip later went up to Asia Minor as his residence, just like John went up there at a later date. You're calling attention to the fact that there was this Philip who converted many, and he felt that they should, in order to get the gift of the Holy Spirit, that it would be necessary for him to have Peter and John come down and lay their hands on these new converts, and in order that they'd receive this gift. So that Philip is called usually the evangelist in your normal reading of by, especially in the biblical comments, in the comments that you. So this Philip is an apostle, just like the one in John that we called that. But what Brother here is calling attention to Jack, that Philip is another Philip with regard to the Ethiopian. We were just correcting the part that the Lord brought that Philip down to him rather than the other way around. Yes?
I think it's so remarkable when he calls out, "Understandest what thou readest," to the chariot that's going.
Yes.
And
how can I except one teach me or tell me? And says, for this he said, he was reading Esaias, and it had to do with Jesus. He didn't, it was probably chapter 53 of Isaiah that he was reading.
Did I understand that the Greeks were living in Jerusalem? Are you going to?
Well, no, no. And that's what I'm trying to say, that there were a lot of foreigners in Israel, but not down in Jerusalem. They would be residing up around the Sea of Galilee. Because that's why it's called Galilee of Nations. Because in Jewish history, many of the Gentiles liked it. It was like a health spa. It's very nice up in Galilee. Climate-wise, it's 800 feet below sea level, so you'd have no severe winter. It's a mild climate all year round, but not as hot as the 2,400 feet below sea level, three times more, of Jericho. So they'd have like summer all year round in Galilee, but not the scorching heat of Jericho. Yes?
Frank, at first I was a little surprised because I guess in my own mind I always thought that the Philip with the Ethiopian eunuch was the Apostle Philip. But in Acts 6, verse 5, it does bear out the point that it is not that it is a different Philip. When it talks about, in verse 2, it says the 12 called the multitude of disciples. It wasn't the idea of the part about that they wasn't fitting that they should leave the word of God to serve tables. And so then when the seven were chosen, it mentions this Philip as being one of the seven that were chosen, differentiating them from the 12.
Yeah.
So that kind of...
There were two Philips, otherwise. And at least four Marys.
Yeah.
And a couple James. And a couple Judases. So it can be confusing when you read the account. And so they asked Jesus, "Sir," say, this is the thought that makes me think that he was at least appearance-wise, not, we're not talking about character-wise, would be more approachable because he would be have some of the culture and background that they would feel he'd be the one to approach. But he realized that he, even though being an apostle, that he lacked certain seniority. So he goes to Andrew, who was Peter's older brother. And he knew that in that way, by going through that, they could get the master's ear. And that deference is becoming, even for an apostle. And again, Andrew and Philip tell Jesus. So he felt it was worthwhile to call it to Jesus. Now, I don't know if we have time for a little more. We'll read through 27 and stop there next, please. What? We won't have time?
I have quarter of one.
Oh.
I had only five.
But usually we end at 12:30, although we have...
We
did have an extended business meeting, so I don't know how that
quarter to one.
I was thinking of five of 12, I guess. I'm in dreamland. So we'll conclude the study here. And it'll be pretty interesting here because as to how this aroused Jesus to make the comments that he did subsequent to this news. So we'll close here.